Over the last two lectures, I've argued, broadly speaking, for a hierarchical approach in thinking about ethics as governs our interactions with animals. And I suppose there's been a running sub-theme as well, which is that normative ethics is pretty complicated, but it's just going to be even more complicated once we take seriously the requirement to extend our normative theory in a sufficient way, in an adequate way, to govern our treatment with animals. It would be easier if we were Unitarians and believe there's just really one kind of moral status. But once you accept the idea that, no, we need hierarchy, then all sorts of principles need to be tweaked in various ways. We saw some of that in yesterday's lecture when I talked about deontology. And even in the places where the principles maybe don't need to be especially tweaked, just thinking them through where they apply to our interactions with animals, it ends up being complicated, I found, in all sorts of surprising ways. I'll just give you a trivial example of that, and then we'll go into a lengthier example. And then, if I have managed to get through the lengthier example quickly enough, I'll say something about the foundations of ethics towards the end, at least a little bit. The trivial example is just this. I found myself thinking about playing catch with a dog. So you've all done it, or you've all seen people do it. You know, you throw the ball, and the dog happily runs off and gets the ball, brings it back to you, and you throw the ball, right? And then you go like this, and you don't let go of the ball. Are you lying to the dog when you do that? Are you deceiving the dog when you do that? If it is, it's probably not lying because you're not saying anything, but you know, it seems like it's deception. Is that acceptable? I mean, it seems crazy to think that that could be wrong, but you know, it is deception. It looks like it's deception to me. Of course, when I play that game with you, if I do it, maybe there's some kind of consent there. Can dogs consent? Do they understand the idea of being faked out, and have they consented to it? Jeff says yes. Okay, so we can move on. I just found myself really baffled by this question. But anyway, that's not the example I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is defense. I have in mind cases where humans are attacking animals or animals are attacking humans. Although I'll continue to talk about humans, what I really mean are people. And cases where animals are attacking animals. But let's start by just trying to remind ourselves of what the basic rules look like when it comes to defense. If you've got a person attacking a person. Normally, what we think, of course, normally it's not okay for me to go up to you and hurt you. But if you've attacked me, then it's another matter. I can justifiably use force against you. And there's various theories about how best to work out the justification of that view, and I'm not going to go there today. I want to just explore a bit of the contours of the, as we might put it, the right to self-defense. One of the sort of simple thoughts is that, so if you've attacked me, then I can use force to stop you. If you were trying to kill me, then it's legitimate for me to use force. Indeed, most of us think it's lethal force to defend myself. There are, of course, people who think that's not right, and I don't mean to be dismissive of that view, but I'm not going to try to attempt to argue against that. I want to explore what should we say about interactions with animals in this domain, assuming that there's, at least between you and me, a right to self-defense. Now, the right to self-defense is complicated in various ways. And again, this is probably going to be familiar to probably everybody here, but let's just review a couple of the relevant points. One point is that the right to self-defense requires that we throw in some kind of necessity condition. If I could fend off your attack on me by saying boo, and then that would scare you, and you'd drop your weapon and run away, then I can't shoot you. I can't kill you at that point, pleading self-defense. But in the examples that we're going to be talking about, let's assume that necessity is in place. There's no way to stop the attacker without using if not lethal force, at least some considerable amount of violent force in, imposing harm on the attacker, and that's what we think is legitimate. So that's a necessity condition, but it won't be doing a lot of work here. Second thought, that it's a familiar one, also complicated. I mean, we're actually spelling out the necessity condition, not a trivial matter, but as I say, I think for our purposes, we don't have to go there. Another condition that's interesting and complicated, but the basic idea seems straightforward, is that the right to self-defense isn't limited to self-defense. It also includes the right of having others defend you, or perhaps we could say it's the right of other defense, so that, you know, if A is attacking B and B is incapable of defending herself or incapable of defending herself effectively, or just C happens to be there and wants to lend a hand, then ordinarily C can come to B's defense against the attack by the evil aggressor A. All right, so there's some kind of rule that permits other defense, and that's the kind of situation that I'm actually most interested in, because what I want to think about are cases where, you know, there's maybe a person attacking an animal, can we come to the animal's defense? Or there's an animal attacking the person, and can we come to the person's defense, and so forth. The third rule is trickier, and it's going to be doing more work in what follows. At least I'll be appealing explicitly to it more frequently. There's some kind of proportionality rule. Now, suppose that what the attacker was going to do, so I'm the evil attacker, and I'm, you know, you've got the right to kill me to stop me from killing you. But suppose I wasn't going to kill you. All I was going to do, all I was going to do was chop off your arms and legs, but you'd survive. Well, and the only way that you could stop me was by killing me first, you know, before I get to it. So intuitively, what most of us feel about the right to self-defense is that you as the victim or others coming to your defense have the right to impose more harm on the attacker than the attacker was intending to impose on you, the victim. You're not limited to only using the amount of harm that you would have befallen you if you hadn't managed to deflect it. So that, you know, if the only way to stop me from chopping off your arms and legs is to shoot me dead first, then most of us would think, okay, that's permissible. You can impose more harm on the attacker than the attacker was going to impose on you, the victim. That's true as we make, you know, suppose I'm not going to chop off both arms and legs, but just one arm, and the only way to stop me is to kill me. Probably most of us think that's still legitimate. And as we make the harms that I, the attacker, was going to impose smaller and smaller and smaller, there'd be some point at which most of us would say, all right, now if the only way to stop the attacker is to kill him, maybe that's not justified anymore. There's going to be some limit to the amount of harm that you can impose on the attacker in order to defend yourself, or for that matter, that others on your behalf could impose on the attacker as a means of stopping the attack. There's a kind of proportionality constraint, as it's often called. The label's not perfect because, of course, part of what I'm trying to bring out here is that the proportionality constraint doesn't really require a one-to-one proportion, but there's some kind of multiplier, yet another multiplier, where, again, to me, the rule is probably more complicated than this, but at least as a first approximation, it's as though you get to impose on the attacker up to M times the amount of harm that the attacker was going to impose on you. You know, if it's too much harm, then it's disproportionate. You know, if all that I was going to do was slug you in the nose, then there'd be a certain amount of harm, more than that, that you could do to stop me. But you, intuitively, as far as I'm concerned, you couldn't kill me to stop me from slugging you once in the nose. So that would exceed the proportionality multiplier M. All right, so the picture, I wonder if I dare move this without utterly destroying it like I did yesterday. The picture is very simple. So if here's the attacker, you know, one person. So he's busy attacking it, that's P1. He's busy attacking some other person, P2. Here's the amount of harm, little lowercase h, the P2 will suffer if the attack is successful. P2, the victim, is permitted by the rules of self-defense to impose a greater amount of harm. That's why it's capital H. But it's got to stay within the bounds of relevant proportion, so there's some multiplier M. The amount of harm you're imposing on the attacker, H, capital H, has to be less than M times the amount of harm that would have befallen you, the victim, lowercase h, for some suitable M. You know, so those of you who are paying attention are probably already thinking, where does that M come from, and how does that M vary? And that's the sort of thing that we're going to be thinking about. But at any rate, so that's the basic setup for self-defense. It gets much more complicated in lots of ways, but that's going to be enough to make things plenty complicated for our purposes. Now, that was a person attacking another person. But I'm interested in the cases where we're interacting with animals, and so we want to substitute animals in one or two or maybe both of these places. We want to have cases where there's a person attacking an animal, a case where there's an animal attacking a person, a case where there's an animal attacking an animal, because then that'll still allow the question, what can we do on behalf of the victim? The victim animal or the attacked animal. All right, so let's just go work through them, because all I really want to say is, gosh, this gets complicated very, very quickly. And gets even more complicated if we try to incorporate hierarchy in the way that I believe that we should be doing. So we start with a case where a person is, and in these initial examples, and for a very long time, I mean what you probably implicitly assumed all along, that's an unprovoked attack. Eventually I'll say something about provoked attacks. The attack's unprovoked, at least until I say otherwise. Okay, so we need a case where a person is unprovokedly attacking an animal. So, for example, there's a hunter who is about to shoot and kill a deer. That would seem to fit the situation. And what the initial rules seems to say is, look, when an attacker is in an unprovoked way attacking a victim, then it's permissible for the victim to use lethal force to repel the attack, and it's permissible for third parties to get involved to come to the defense of the victim. So that seems to suggest, at first pass at least, that it would be permissible for us, seeing the hunter about to shoot the deer, to use lethal force to stop the hunter from shooting the deer. Now, I have to say, that seems to fall out pretty quickly and fairly straightforwardly once you take animal status seriously, animal standing seriously. And yet it's a pretty shocking thought. I mean, even those of us who are used to thinking about the rights of animals and animal standing and animal ethics, you know, normally shy away from thinking it's okay to kill somebody who's hunting. Yet it looks as though this kind of rule, once you've got it as part of your morality, and then you include animals within moral standing, it looks like it's going to follow. All right, so the next obvious question is, you know, what kind of replies might be given on behalf of the hunter? That is to say, what kind of answers might we give to say, no, this is why it's not really legitimate to kill the hunter? Well, so one obvious thought is, you might say, and sometimes people will say, what if the hunter is killing the deer out of necessity? That's the only way for the hunter to stay alive. Wouldn't that be legitimate for the hunter to do? And so wouldn't it be wrong then for you to defend the deer? And not only do I think that that's right, basically that's what I insisted on in yesterday's lecture. Yeah, that was the Tom Hanks example, killing the deer, killing the fish, whatever it might be, so as to stay alive. Indeed, I used the very thought that that must be permissible so as to motivate within deontology the need for a hierarchical approach. So I certainly do want to say when somebody's hunting out of necessity, it's another matter. But of course, most people in our society, maybe anybody in our society, we don't hunt out of necessity. We hunt for sport. And so even if it is the case that if you were going to die otherwise, the amount of good that you would do by preserving your own life as a person outweighs the threshold of the right to life that the animal might have, the deer might have, where you're going to die otherwise, that's not going to work for justifying sport hunting. And so, again, it seems to follow that in an instance of sport hunting, killing the hunter is morally justified. Kind of surprising result, but it looks as though that's what you get if you take these ideas seriously. So what's another response? Well, another response would be to say, look, start thinking about the amount of good and bad that's involved here and so forth. And can't we say that, look, there's less loss for the deer? Yeah, there is less loss for the deer than maybe the person victim would have lost. But so what? So what? If we've got this multiplier, then it doesn't have to be that the deer's loss would be as large as the hunter's loss when the hunter loses their life. Given that we think there's this big multiplier, maybe not insanely big, but three times as much, five times as much, 10 times as much, whatever it might be, then unless the deer's life really barely registers at all as valuable, then it looks as though it's still going to be, so it's permissible for us on behalf of the deer to impose much more harm on the hunter than the deer is going to suffer. And if maybe that'll still bring us up to killing the hunter, but if not that, maiming the hunter looks like it would still be justified. Again, it seems surprising, but for all that does seem to me what follows. Now it's slightly more complicated yet again. Because the question is, look, the multiplier M, even though we didn't try to work out what it was, the multiplier M, supposing that we did settle on what M looked like, is at least potentially a function of the fact that in the paradigmatic case of one person killing another person, we have a person up here in the attacker role and a person down here in the victim role. In the case of the hunter attacking the deer, that's not all right. I mean, the victim is now a deer, and so obviously it doesn't follow from anything else that I've said previously, but it seems at least in the spirit of the sorts of considerations I've put forward previously that maybe the size of M is partially dependent on the moral status of the victim. When it's a person defending themselves against a person, you have this right to this large multiplier M. But if the victim is a lower status animal, then perhaps M shrinks accordingly. And if M shrinks accordingly, then as we start thinking about, bearing in mind the fact that the hunter is going to lose a human life, that's worth a lot. The deer is only going to lose a deer's life, that's a smaller amount of harm. Now we have a smaller M as well. It's more likely at this point that it may no longer be permissible to kill the hunter, though I don't think we can yet rule it out. But at least now the door's open to saying, maybe killing the hunter won't be justified. And of course, if we replaced the victim not with a deer, but with a fish, let's say, or a mouse, or something, as we move to lower and lower statuses, if M gets proportionately smaller and smaller, it becomes easier to justify harming the it becomes harder to justify harming the hunter in that large amount, especially since, likely enough, you're not only shrinking the size of M, you're also shrinking the size of lowercase h with animals of lower and lower status. So it's going to be less and less harm that you're justified to impose on the hunter. And yet, for all that, as far as I can see, there's still going to be some. These multipliers limit how much harm you can do, but they don't have the implication that you can't impose harm at all. So maybe all I can do is stab the hunter to stop them from killing the deer or what have you. But that's still surprising. But as far as I can see, something like that might follow so far. At that point, you might wonder about, maybe animals don't really have a right to self-defense at all, in which case maybe we don't have a right as third parties to come in, as it were, defending their right to self-defense if they haven't got one. that might make sense. I mean, I'm not saying it would make sense, but at least you could see how that would be an idea worth entertaining seriously if we could exclude animals from deontology. But of course, some large portion of yesterday's talk was devoted to trying to say that although the idea that animals should not have deontological protections like the right to self-defense, a right to life, and so forth, although that idea is a common enough one, I don't think it's defensible. So the thought that animals lack a right to self-defense seems to me one that we shouldn't be embracing. So at least that way out wouldn't work either. One other way out would be to say, even if it's true that in principle there's a right to self-defense, and in principle that's going to justify imposing a certain amount of violent harm upon the hunter, nonetheless, for pragmatic reasons, that's a mistake, right? If animal liberationists go around stabbing hunters, let alone killing them, that's not really going to help the movement. And in the long run, that's not going to help us forward the cause of making sport hunting illegal. And so in the long run, that's not really going to help more animals. The results will be worse if you do it. Now, that's a complicated empirical question. I don't know whether it's really true or not, but suppose it's true. It certainly has kind of a ring of armchair plausibility. But then I'm going to say, I don't know if that's really going to do the trick. So here you have to remember the duty to rescue, which I brought up briefly last time, where we say, look, under circumstances where there's a drowning kid, I think I probably talked about miners in the mine shaft, right, and how we're prepared to spend a lot of money to save the miners who are in danger right here and right now, even though we know full well that by virtue of having spent that money, we'll have less money to spend on mining safety and more miners will die. That's what the duty to rescue looks like from a deontological perspective. But then that means I'm not justified in saying I'm going to refuse to come to the aid of the victim now on the grounds that doing so would be better for more animals down the road. If the duty to rescue works the way it appears to rescue, it blocks that answer. All right, so it looks like, from a deontological perspective at least, or our common sense views about defense, extending that to animals in the hunter case, violent harm to the hunter is justified. If we had more time, we might go further and ask, is it required? That's what the duty to rescue suggests, or is it merely permissible? But all right, that was one kind of case. So that was the case where there's a person still in the attacker role, but an animal in the victim role. So let's now try switching it. What about a case where you've got an animal in the attacking role and a person in the victim role? Maybe now there's a lion that has entered into the village, the African village, and is threatening to, that is, it looks like, based on the available evidence, suggests it's going to, will in fact, kill some human child. Can we kill the lion to stop it from killing the human child? Well, again, at first glance, or another case that comes to mind, this is from, these things happen actually in reality, but for me, the example is in the novel To Kill a Mockingbird. There's a particular scene where a rabid dog is headed down the street, and the only way to stop it is to shoot it. So again, you might think that, okay, here's a threat of rabies, which can be life-threatening, and the only way to stop it is to shoot it. All right, so something like this, the animal attacker, human victim. Can we come to the defense of the victim? Well, okay, at first glance, here it seems like yes. Intuitively, it seems as though the answer is obviously yes, and it looks as though the same rules are going to entail the answer yes. You're entitled to come to the aid of the victim from the unprovoked attack by the lion or the rabid dog or whatever it might be. Well, but now there's an extra complication that we have to bring to the table, which is that in the example as I originally introduced it of P1 attacking P2, the attacker is deliberately, self-consciously, fully in control of himself or herself, knowing what they're up to. They're an evil aggressor, kind of fill in whatever your relevant details might be. And clearly that's not what's going on when you have the lion attacking the child. The lion is not fully conscious of the rules of deontological morality. Yesterday, I think it was, I said in response to a question that I think we're too quick to think that there's nothing like moral behavior in the rest of the animal kingdom. I think there is. But clearly, the kind of highly self-conscious thoughts about the rules governing unprovoked attacks and like that, that's beyond, I take it, the cognitive capacities of a lion. And if you happen to know something about lion psychology to suggest that that's not so, fill in some other, fill in the rabid dog or whatever it might be. So in the language that gets used in the animal attacking victim case, what we've got is not a deliberate aggressor, but something more like what gets known as an innocent threat. The label, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is probably fairly self-explanatory. The attacker is a threat, right? But it's not a deliberate evil aggressor. There's a kind of innocence that surrounds them, a non-recognition of what they're doing. They're not completely in control of the situation in the way the deliberate aggressor is. And that means the next question we have to ask ourselves is it permissible to harm, in defense of oneself or of others, innocent threats? There are various examples that get thrown around of innocent threats in the literature. Here's one kind of example. Imagine that some three-year-old picks up what is in fact a loaded gun, but takes it to be a toy gun, points it at and is about to shoot the trigger and will kill you. You can't sort of knock it out of their hand. The only thing that you can do is kill them first. Well, that would be a case of using lethal force against an innocent threat. And the question you've got to ask yourself is that permissible or not? Here's another case that gets thrown around in the literature. The wind picks you up, throws you down a very long pit where you will land on and kill somebody who's, I don't know why, lounging at the bottom of the pit. They can't get out of the way. That's why we put this in a pit. You're going to crush them to death. But they've got, their vaporizing ray gun, and can they permissibly vaporize you, thereby defending themselves against the lethal threat that you pose? Now, of course, it's not your fault. We're to imagine that you're picked up by the wind, so you're an innocent threat. And again, the question is, may you use lethal force against this kind of human wind-flown missile? Now, the interesting thing is that people in the philosophy literature disagree about the permissibility of using lethal force against innocent threats. My sense is that most people on the street think it's okay, though a sizable minority think not. And maybe that is represented or reflected in the philosophical literature as well. Most people that I'm aware of in the literature think it's okay. There's a sizable minority that says no. I hope I'm not getting you wrong, Jeff. Jeff thinks not, unless he's changed his mind. So Jeff thinks it's not okay to kill innocent threats. So, he's the White's professor. It's an idea worth taking seriously, that it might be wrong to kill innocent threats. I'm not going to try to settle that here, although anybody who wants to think about this needs to think about the fact that there are threats, right? And the animal case isn't really quite like the missile case, because in the wind case, the person has no control whatsoever of what they're doing, whereas in some sense, the lion is attacking you, has control. In the case of the kid with the gun, the kid doesn't realize that what it's about to do is a threat to you, whereas in the lion case, the lion presumably does realize what it's about to do is a threat to its victim, it's trying to get food or eating, whatever it might be. So it's not quite like those threats, and so whatever arguments you might have about the permissibility or impermissibility of attacking those other kinds of classic examples of threats may not quite apply. I'm not going to try to settle that here. So let's just try to take a look at each possibility in turn. First, let's suppose that harming an innocent threat is forbidden. It's not okay. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't really mean it's wrong under any circumstances. What it really means is the special liability that would normally come about for having harm directed towards you, that happens in cases of deliberate aggressors, that special liability isn't there. But the ordinary permissibility conditions will still be there. So when is it ordinarily? So if killing an innocent threat is not permissible, what that really means is it's just as bad as killing a bystander. And the fact that the lion's attacking the child, that's neither here nor there. It's as though the only way to save the child was to go grab some random person and kill them. And because of some bizarre causal story, that would save the life of the victim. Now, of course, we typically think that would not be permissible, but we did, on the other hand, if we were moderate deontologists, as we saw yesterday, think that when there's enough good at stake, then that might well permit killing even a bystander to do enough good. And so even if it's impermissible qua innocent threat to kill the attacking lion, nonetheless, if the amount of good that would be done by saving the human victim, if it were great enough to meet the threshold for the right to life of the attacking lion, then maybe it would be permissible to harm the lion or for us to harm the lion after all. Of course, at this point, we have to then ask ourselves, so is that threshold met here or not? And then we have to remember that although the lion has less harm at stake, because the lion's life is worth less, has less value, less good in it, lower level of well-being than the human will go on to have unless it gets eaten by the lion, still, since thresholds tend to be many, many, many times greater than the harm imposed, I think yesterday I used as a minimum number 1,000, you'd have to think something on the order of the human's life was 1,000 times more, right? Of course, now, on the other hand, yesterday I suggested that maybe thresholds for animals are lower than thresholds for people, and so that will lower the amount of good. But on the other hand, it's just literally not clear to me whether having done that, we will be at a situation at which we can say the amount of good that we do by saving the human victim from the attacking lion is enough to meet even the admittedly reduced threshold of the lion. It may just be that, and again, this is just kind of shocking, if you think that it's impermissible to kill innocent threats, it may just be that you have to say, you know what, the lion's about to eat your kid. It would be wrong for you to stop it. Again, that seems surprising, but if that's not right, if that's not what follows from taking the rights of animals seriously, the question then becomes, why doesn't it? Now, as it happens, for me, I think the reason it doesn't follow is because I'm not with Jeff. I don't believe it's true that you can't harm innocent threats. But instead of trying to defend that, let's just switch over to the other side and ask what happens if it is okay to harm innocent threats. Can we now say, oh, all right, so now we're done. You can harm innocent threats. No, it's unfortunately or happily, depending on your taste for this sort of thing, more complicated. Why? Because to say it's not okay to harm innocent threats didn't really mean under any circumstances. To say that it is okay to harm innocent threats doesn't really mean under any circumstances. There'll still be a proportionality condition. Now, at first glance, you might say, okay, well, that's fine. The proportionality condition is satisfied. Human life's worth a lot more than the lion's life. And then you throw in the multiplier M, now we're done, right? The multiplier M is going to make it even permissible to impose even more harm on the lion. But not so quick. So when we think about the size of M, our original intuitions, whatever they were, suppose we had fixed them about the size of M, that the amount of extra or disproportionate amount of harm that you're allowed to use to defend a human victim against a human attacker, that assumed that the attacker was a deliberate attacker. And what I think a lot of us would feel, even those of us who do think it's permissible to impose, M times as much harm on a deliberate aggressor, Even those of us who think, and in addition, it's permissible to harm innocent threats, I at least find myself thinking, and I don't think I'm unique in this, that there's less harm that you're permitted to impose on an innocent threat than you are on a deliberate aggressor. Which is to say, the size of M shrinks by virtue of the fact that the attacker here is not a deliberate attacker, but an innocent threat. Now, if we really had our theory of innocent threats worked out, we'd know what kind of shrinkage takes place here, and we know that maybe since there are innocent threats of different kinds, I was suggesting, we'd have to get our pinpoint what exactly is the kind of innocent threat that the lion is, and that would help us get a sense of how much it's shrunk. But intuitively, some shrinkage takes place. Indeed, there's an interesting connection. I'll just digress on this for a moment. You know, so you start here with the deliberate aggressor, and there's this big M that you're allowed to use that can impose many times more harm on the aggressor. But as we move to innocent threats, and really a very full theory, he would probably talk about degrees of innocence or something like that. As we move to greater degrees of innocence, still it's a threat, right? So there's an M, but it's smaller. As you move to the bystander case, probably M has shrunken down so much that it's actually a fraction of one. To say that it's a fraction of one is precisely to say, not only aren't I allowed to impose M times as much harm on the bystander, I'm only allowed to impose an mth as much harm, which is just to say there's a threshold of that. That's looking at our old familiar threshold from the other side around, that the benefit to me has to be many times as great as the harm that I'm imposing, or the benefit to me and my colleagues. So I think there's a kind of unified view underlying all of this, even though initially it looks like just two different principles of morality. But at any rate, the thought was that when it comes to innocent threats, M will shrink. Because M shrinks, it becomes proportionately harder to justify any given amount of force on the lion in defense of the child. But on the other hand, just like when I earlier said, you know, M may shrink by virtue of the lower status of the animal victim, M may shrink by virtue, do I have this right? Is it M shrink? Now I get myself lost. M may change, let's be safer that way. M may change by virtue of the fact that we've got a animal here instead of, no, it may grow. That was what I wanted to say. That's the right thing to say. It's that, look, it was one thing to say I can use M times as much harm against a person. But if I'm defending myself against something with lower status, maybe I can use more than M times as much harm. Good. All right. So we've got one consideration, the lower status of the attacker, which raises M. And we've got one consideration, the innocence of the attacker, which shrinks M. Having said all of that, where are we left? Are we left with a multiplier bigger than M or smaller than M? I haven't the slightest idea. I think we're completely in the dark about this. We don't yet have a moral theory worked out that allows us to answer even this kind of straightforward case. And is the resulting M, whatever size it is, big enough to justify killing the lion so as to defend your child? I think we just don't know. All right, so that's the case of animal attacking person. What about animal attacking animal? All right, so again, the thing would be, you know, there's the lion now not attacking a human, but attacking a zebra. Actually, just, I can't resist. One more just little observation about the animal attacking human case. It's important that just like we saw, things turn out different if the attacker is innocent versus deliberate and so forth. It's also going to, how culpable is the victim? That may affect things as well, right? So I deliberately used a sweet little human child sleeping in their cradle while the lion, you know, stalks tonight. I want to sing in Weem Away. But, you know, suppose what's really going on is the victim's an adult human who's been poking around where they shouldn't be poking around. Here's the easy case. Suppose that the victim had deliberately started shooting at the quote-unquote attacker. So it wasn't, when the attacker defends itself, it's not really an unprovoked attack, it's self-defense, right? So here's the hunter shooting at the lion, and the lion in self-defense starts charging at the hunter, well, see above, now we don't think it's okay to come to the defense of the hunter. Well, what if it wasn't deliberately provoking the lion, but just stupidly provoking the lion? You know, you're wandering in bear country, and you should have known better than to go into the caves where the mama bears tend to hang out with their cubs. And now you've provoked the bear, who now reasonably concludes that you're a threat to its cubs, and it starts attacking you. Really, it's just not clear at this point whether or not you can defend yourself against the attacking bear. That's surprising as well. All right, but let's now move on to the case of animals versus animals. So the lion attacks the zebra. Can we come to the zebra's defense? Well, suppose we start with the thought that, again, the lion will be some kind of innocent threat. Not the standard kind, because it realizes it's posing a harm. It has control over that, but just doesn't have the right kind of... It's a little bit more like a crazy person that's a threat, but not exactly like that. So the lion's an innocent threat, and we're going to assume that it's not permissible to kill innocent threats. But what that really means is we have to think of this more like a bystander case. That means we can come to the defense of the zebra only if the good we do by defending the zebra is great enough to outweigh the threshold, as moderate deontologists, the threshold of the right to life of the lion. Okay. Now, in the ordinary case, the answer would be, well, I don't know. If it's an innocent threat and it's not permissible, so the person-to-person case, then you're saying, you know, can't, in order to save one person's life, can I kill a bystander? No, the threshold hasn't been met. The life of the beneficiary isn't so valuable to outweigh the threshold of the right to life of the bystander that we'd be killing. So, in thinking about the lion to zebra case, at first glance, it looks as though we should come away saying you could only, and if you also do believe it's impermissible to harm innocent threats, you'd have to say we could only justify coming to the defense using lethal force or violent force against the lion so as to defend the zebra if the good done by saving the zebra's life was great enough to outweigh the threshold of the lion's life or its right to life, and that's not so. Except it's more complicated because the relevant question is the good that you're doing good enough to meet the threshold? And intuitively what we're saying is in a one-to-one, person-to-person case, no. You can't justify killing one person so as to save one person from a deontological perspective. But neither the good that we're doing nor the threshold that we have to meet or surpass is the same with an animal-to-animal case as we had with a person-to-person case. Yesterday I argued for the fact that, or at least what I take to be true, that from a deontological perspective you should say that the threshold is lower. Not just that the amount of harm is less, and so fed into the same threshold function as always, you get a lower threshold when the attacker is an animal. But in fact, the threshold function itself is a lesser function, generating smaller thresholds for the same size harm. And if all that's right, that means the threshold for the lion's a whole lot smaller. How much smaller, we're not in a position yet to say, but at least in qualitative terms, the threshold for the lion is smaller than the threshold would be if the bystander were a person. And that speaks in favor of it being more likely that it will turn out to be permissible to harm the lion so as to save the zebra. On the other hand, the benefit to the zebras not the same as if the victim were a person either, right? Not only is it the case, this brings us back to the Unitarian point from lecture number one, not only is it the case that the zebra's got less on the table than the lion does, or rather than we would have if the human victim, sorry, misspoke. Not only does the zebra have less on the table, so there's less benefit. There's also the possibility, which I suggested I was sympathetic to in lecture number one, that the function that takes you from the amount of welfare to the amount of good that you've done by protecting that amount of welfare, that the welfare function itself needs to be hierarchically sensitive. So that the lower the status of the being, the less good that's done by the same number of units of well-being. And if that's right, then we do even less good by defending the zebra. Not only is the amount of well-being less, but unit for unit, zebra well-being counts less than person well-being. And that argues against the thought that the threshold has been met. So now again, we have these two opposing forces. We've got the hierarchically sensitive theory pushes us towards saying it's easier to justify attacking the zebra. The hierarchically sensitive theory of well-being and good pushes us towards saying it's harder to justify using force to defend the zebra. Which of these forces wins out? I don't really know. My intuition is, I don't know, maybe it's a tie. Sort of these two forces more or less cancel each other out. And so we're left where we were with a person-to-person case where you can't kill one innocent person to save one other innocent person. Notice, by the way, that argument that I just concluded with turns on, at least appeals to implicitly, the thought that, at least when I think through, I think it would probably be more accurate to say, I find myself drawn to the conclusion that probably it's still a tie, we probably don't have enough good there to justify meeting the threshold, that the zebra and the lion are roughly the same status. So the amount of harm or benefits roughly the same, and the modifications of the threshold function and the well-being to good function roughly the same to roughly cancel out. I don't have those things worked out to make good on it, but that's definitely influencing my own judgment about this. And that suggests that if we move to two other cases where there was more of a difference in the hierarchical status of the animal that's attacking and the animal that's the victim, we might get rather different results. So suppose, just to be very extreme about it, we've got a black widow spider as the attacker attacking a kangaroo. Well, then I'm inclined to say that, look, you know, there's these big differences in the amount of well-being that's at stake, and the threshold for the black widow spider, very low on the hierarchy scale, so the threshold is going to be very low. Intuitively, I suspect, all right, that's going to yield a case where we can, you know, well, we can step on the spider to save the kangaroo. Turn it the other way around. High-level attacker to low-level victim. I don't know what I should use. The best I could come up with was an anteater eating an ant. And all right, so there's a case where, you know, the amount of well-being that the ants got at stake, if any, very, very little, since I think some because of the agency thing from lecture number one. But the amount's very, very small. The benefit of protecting the ant, vanishingly small, especially after reduced for its very low hierarchy. The case of the anteater, higher status, higher threshold, probably you can't come to the defense of the ant by harming the anteater. All right, there's still more to say about all of this, but I did promise you on lecture one that I would say something about foundations of ethics, and I only have a few minutes left, so let me make a point, or maybe two, depending on how quickly I can get through them. Of the various problems, you know, so I've spent these lectures arguing for a hierarchical view about animal ethics, or ethics would really just be a more accurate thing to say, and the basic underlying thought is that the features, whatever they are, that generate moral status go from less to more, and absent some special argument, which I'm not able to come up with, it seems plausible to think that the more F you've got, the higher status you've got, the less F you've got, the lower status you've got. That's got some results that I find very congenial. You know, so animals seem to have some status. They're going to count more than certainly most people treat them with. They deserve more. They have a claim to more than we give them. Animals count more. But for all that, they have less F than we have, so animals count less than we do. So they count more and less. Hence the title of these series. How to count animals, more or less. Is that where it came from? You think? Okay. So
There are other cases where the results are less obviously wonderful. Couldn't there be creatures with more F than us? The superior creatures point, as I discovered, to my delight. People in the audience on Monday, I think, is when we took the poll. Virtually everybody was on board with that. All right, so maybe that's not a worrisome result. There's also the possibility of humans with significantly less F than anybody in this room has, and then it looks like they're going to have lower moral status. That's the so-called problem of marginal cases. And that, I think, is genuinely troubling. I think it's a pill that's the right pill to swallow. Like anything else in philosophy, you lay out the various alternatives. You see what costs strike you as larger than other costs, or which has the best ratio of benefits to costs. For me, that's the one I'm prepared to pay. Can mollify it somewhat by appealing to this notion of modal persons that I introduced. But still, you know, a lot of people are going to be unhappy about that. I find it troubling, but I'm prepared to pay it. But the problem that I was most troubled by was the problem that I called normal variation, where the amount of F held by the people in this room probably isn't all the same, whatever our pet theory of F is. And so that's going to mean that, doesn't it follow that some of us have stronger rights than others, and it would take more to justify killing us than him, than her, or her, than him? And that seems very unpalatable. Again, you could just say, oh, no, I'm not troubled by it, and then you're not troubled by it. But I'd rather find a way to avoid it. The trouble is, of course, part of my entire argument was that F varies continuously. It doesn't have to literally be continuous. There can be gaps and steps and like, but it's plausible to think that there'll be variation in F within, you know, a large enough population of people. So it's going to have different statuses. What we'd like to have is a way of saying not every variation in F gives you a different status. What we really want, what I really want, is a kind of step function where small amounts of F give you a certain status, and then there's another range of F amount that gives you a higher status, and another range of F amount that gives you a higher status, where, yeah, at any given step, there can still be variation in the amount of F, but for all that, those minor variations, normal variation, aren't sufficient to push you into another step. Even a step function is likely to leave you with the conclusion that marginal cases are at lower steps. But I'd at least like to get rid of having variation among the people in this room. And then that's kind of the deep philosophical question. How do you turn, what could possibly justify turning that kind of, roughly speaking, continuous variable into a step function output? And although I have very little time, let me very quickly sketch the sort of solution that seems to me the most promising. First, I have to tell you something about, or remind you something about, rule utilitarianism. All right, so again, probably almost everybody here knows about this, but just in case not. So with rule utilitarianism, the basic idea is right and wrong is a matter of obeying the rules, which are optimal as measured against a certain kind of yardstick, you know, the best outcome. And the interesting thing about rule utilitarianism, so we ask ourselves, you know, what would the results be if people tried to follow these rules and so forth? And the interesting thing about rule utilitarianism, or more generally rule consequentialism, is that given certain widely accepted facts, you end up with distinctions showing up in the output rules that were not there in the input value theory. So, for example, famously, rule consequentialists often claim things like, you know, it's worse to kill, that we need a rule against killing innocent people. And admittedly, there may be cases where killing an innocent person would have better results. But for all that, the best rule says don't kill innocent people. Why? Because of certain empirical correlations, right? Acts of killing tend to have bad results, at least when they're acts of killing innocent people. And if you start trying to figure out what are the exceptions, we're very bad at detecting these fine-grained exceptions. If you had a rule that gave us permission to kill innocent people when it was one of those exceptions, unusual cases, the odds are we'd screw it up in cases where we shouldn't be screwing it up. And so given our epistemic limitations, you end up with a rule that says there's this really important distinction between killing and letting die, even though there's nothing like that in the value theory that was the input to rule consequentialism. Okay, so there's this feature, and there's more details that I'm just going to skip over because I really do want to wrap this up. There's this feature, I think of it as practical realism, where in generating the rules and asking which rules are ideal from the rule consequentialist perspective, we take into account the epistemic limitations of the agents who are going to be acting on the rules. And that generates topography in the output that's distinct from the topography of the input. Practical realism can turn a value system, which was continuous, into a rule system that was discrete. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for something that can turn a continuous f function into a step function as the output. And so the suggestion I want to make is if we're practical realists, for the moment, suppose it's in rule consequentialism, then even though there might be minor variations in status, the ideal set of rules probably wouldn't say, go around trying to determine the precise microstatus of this individual versus that individual, and then treat them, you know, one iota differently. We're more likely to screw that up. The optimal set of rules for epistemically limited creatures like us is likely to be much more coarse-grained rather than fine-grained. Instead of expecting an entire continuous spectrum of hierarchy statuses in ethics, we might expect something more like a half dozen different statuses. You know, there's people, you know, and then there's the great apes and other things like that that seem to be people or near people, you know, and then there's other highly intelligent animals like dogs, and then there's the lower animals like the chickens, and then I haven't got the categories worked out, but the thought that what we might end up with, given practical realism, is just the kind of step function that intuitively avoids the problem of normal variation while still recognizing the kind of differences in standing that I've been arguing for. And then the two more points. So the almost last point is that this kind of practical realism, although most familiar in the context of the foundational theory of rule consequentialism, really is an option for any plausible foundational theory. You know, contractarians trying to figure out what the ideal rules are, if they're going to be practical realists, need to take into account the epistemic limitations of the people who are going to have to live by the rules. So practical realism will also, if your favorite foundational theory is not consequentialist but contractarian, practical realism may still push us towards this kind of coarse-grained hierarchy theory. Or, more surprising but I still think true, suppose you're a Kantian and you think to yourself, okay, the question is, what are the rules that I can will to be universal, I can rationally will to be universal law? As I mentally test out the various rules, I need to be, or at least I can choose to be, a practical realist about it, thinking, okay, these are rules that are going to have to be lived by fallible human beings with epistemic limitations. So again, you might end up with a coarse-grained hierarchy theory from even Kantianism. That's the kind of view, actually, I'm most sympathetic to. All right, so that was the penultimate point. So the last point is this. I just wanted to remind you of sort of where we've been or where I've tried to take you. It's that it seems to me an adequate set of theories with regard to our interactions with animals will need to involve hierarchy in a way that maybe a lot of people find that plausible. What's surprising is how little that view has been developed, as far as I can see, in the philosophical literature. And the second point is that, as I hope you can see, all I've done over the course of the last three lectures is just scratch the surface of beginning to work some of this stuff out. You know, I've gestured towards the thought that the threshold function, for example, might be vary with the hierarchy of the animal. I certainly haven't tried to work it out. We're still, I think, very much in the dark about what an adequate theory with regard to animals would look like, which is why I haven't tried to work out any of these questions with any kind of precision. They've only been rough directions, which is really why I labeled the lecture series as a whole, How to Count Animals, More or Less. Thank you very much.